This is your favorite radio station in Gallatin Valley, Southwest Montana, and the internet, KGVM 95.9 or KGVM.org. I'm Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with co-host Dr. Suzanne Wood, doctoral-level speech-language pathologist. We present you with this program regarding health and happiness. While we emphasize mental health, all good health works to make us more mentally healthy. Today we have a local professional, and Dr. Suzanne will introduce shortly. We thank Bob Wall, KGVM disc jockey and consummate computer specialist, for the technical aspects of this program. We thank the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association for encouraging us to present this program. We thank Kiyoshi Matsuyama for the introductory music creation. Now, Dr. Suzanne.
Helen Keller once said, "The only thing worse than being blind is having sight but no vision." It makes me think every day we should celebrate our vision. It is one of our greatest gifts. In Montana, especially, we can raise our eyes to the mountains, the snowflakes, the stars. And for this session, we will speak to one who spends his life caring about our eyes, our vision. We welcome Dr. Russell Swan, noted eye surgeon. Welcome, Dr. Russell. Tell us what we need to know and what we don't know. We're so looking forward to talking to you.
Well, Arliss and Suzanne, thank you so much for letting me join you guys today. It's a huge honor, and I'm really looking forward to this session. I think, you know, I love that quote from Helen Keller, and I think, you know, it's really interesting when you look at official surveys that are put out on things that people fear most. Going blind and death are usually kind of 1-2 in order, and the survey depends. Some surveys will say death first, and some people will say loss of vision. But it is, you know, our sight is something that is so valuable in each and every moment of our day and what we experience in our day. And I feel super, super lucky to have that be my profession and to get to help people be able to see more clearly, which is really special. So I'm just super thankful for you guys taking time to let me be on, and I'm excited for the conversation and where it might go.
Well, we are too, Dr. Russell. And first of all, maybe you could tell us how you became interested in becoming an eye doctor, what training was required, and kind of let people out there, young people particularly, who might be thinking about this profession, a little bit about how it comes about.
Yeah, that's a great question. The field of eye care is actually a beautiful and wonderful field to be a part of. And I think, you know, there's two kind of primary, what I would call, you know, doctor professional routes to go into eye care. So for me growing up, I grew up in a very small rural town, farming community. And my eye doctor growing up was always my optometrist, Dr. Meyer. And I had the privilege of hanging out with him a lot because I needed glasses when I was in first grade. And that probably kind of first spurred my interest in eye care just as a field, because I was always hanging out in his office. And for the first time I put glasses on and contacts, you know, people talk about trees suddenly not being blobs, but actually having individual leaves that you could see. And I have very distinct memories of that myself. For me, I actually, as I entered college and finished up with college, I eventually decided that I love serving people and I loved helping take care of people. And I was actually pretty set on going into medicine to maybe either be a pediatrician or family practice doctor. And I actually didn't even have in my mindset being an eye surgeon or an ophthalmologist at the time that I started medical school. And the first thing that we studied in medical school, fortunate, I guess, for me, was the eye and the brain and the anatomy. And I just found it just incredibly, incredibly interesting. And I kind of had this light bulb moment where I was like, wait a second, I can do eye surgery through the path of medical school. And what I really loved the more and more I learned about ophthalmology and about eye surgery was, you know, this unique opportunity to walk alongside people during a very vulnerable moment in their life when they're not seeing as well as they used to, and help them improve and see better, whether that be by LASIK or laser vision correction, whether it be by cataract surgery or other forms of cornea transplants or glaucoma surgery. And there's, for me, as I went through med school, it was really reinforcing to me, you know, one of the things that I loved about ophthalmology and eye care was it was one of the few areas of medicine that I was looking at that you really get to make a substantial quantitative improvement in people's quality of life. And a lot of medicine, for better or worse, is kind of about maintaining things or preventing things from getting worse. When you think about a lot of our primary care aspects, which are super great and still very important. But eye care is this very unique place where a lot of times in a very short 5-10 second laser or 5-minute surgery, we can actually improve someone's life and get them vision back that they may have lost, which is a real special thing. So from just a very practical perspective for listeners that are out there, maybe younger in their studies, for optometry or primary eye care, people go to college, finish their college degree, and then do schooling directly into optometry school and spend 4 years doing that and getting training. Some people do an extra year and then are able to go out into practice. And for ophthalmology or eye surgery, the path's a little bit different, but after college, it's 4 years of medical school, general medical school. And then after that, 4 additional years of eye surgery training. And then some people, like myself or others, will do an extra year or two of fellowship training in a specific area like cornea transplants or glaucoma surgery. So it's a long path, but I think both of those careers, primary eye care, optometry, and ophthalmology, very rewarding. And then even within that, there's a lot of sub-careers within the space that aren't necessarily doctor-related that are still really rewarding. We have, you know, research technicians, certified research technicians. We have ophthalmic assistants. There's opticians. So there's all these other kind of subcategories of career paths within eye care that can also be really rewarding and where there's huge need in the state of Montana in particular.
That was going to be my next question. Is there a real need for more professionals who do what you do? I know the answer to that, but maybe you could share that with us.
Yeah. I mean, the short answer is yes, definitely. And the longer answer is, you know, interestingly, most of the what I would term kind of visually significant diseases that we think about and that require a lot of treatment. So cataract, glaucoma, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, you know, almost all of those are also seen at higher rates in patients as they accumulate birthdays or wisdom, as I like to say. Some people as they get older. But as people accumulate wisdom, those are more prevalent. And so as we are entering this baby boomer era, most of those conditions, cataract, glaucoma, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, are expected to double in terms of the patient need for care, while the number of providers is not set to double. So just from a very simple math perspective, there's a huge need across the whole United States and across the world. Montana, that's certainly elevated. And, you know, I think in Gallatin County, we're very fortunate from an eye care provider perspective, both primary eye care optometry and ophthalmology, surgically and retina doctors as well. We're very fortunate to have really great coverage per capita of providers, and it's easy to get in. But there are other places in the state. You know, I practice also in Billings, but Eastern Montana, Great Falls, areas where it's very difficult sometimes to get in to see an eye surgeon, or more challenging because there's just not as good of coverage. And so absolutely, there's a huge demand. And, you know, anyone who expresses interest, I have students all the time, college students, medical students, optometry students who rotate with me. And I'm always advocating for them to hunker down in Montana when they finish up their training, because there is a huge need for it.
Thank you. That's good information to have. And I just want to personally thank you for studying 12 to 14 years in order to help me out. Maybe in my 50s, 40s, I started noticing I needed reading glasses. And then I got the next level up after a while, and I think I went up to the higher levels of these glasses and had prescription glasses. And And then I went to see Dr. Swan, Dr. Russell here, and he did two things. He took care of the cataracts, and he provided lenses whereby I can look up at the mountain and I can see the individual trees on the tree line on the Bridgers from our window. And I can read and sew without my glasses. And it's just been so marvelous to restore my vision to where it was many years before. So when Dr. Swan talks about this, it's not just talk. He really does do these miracles. And perhaps, Dr. Swan, you could talk about what's available for people out there who want to improve their vision, and tell us about your laser surgeries and your other eye care for people now. That the developments have been just fantastic, I believe.
Yeah. Well, one, it was an absolute privilege and to take care of you and continue to take care of you. And yeah, it's, again, I absolutely love what I get to do. And maybe, Suzanne, with that question, what I might start with, just because it's most related to your kind of personal, you know, journey and story that you just shared, is talking a little bit about cataract surgery and cataracts, because that's one of the most common visual complaints that I see on a day-to-day basis. And then we can maybe, after that, maybe talk a little bit about some of the other laser vision correction options like LASIK or PRK or implantable contact lenses for younger patients. But, you know, cataract surgery, and I think you explained it so beautifully, our lens, we're born with kind of a natural, I call it our reading lens, inside of our eye. And it sits right behind the colored part of our eye. And you described it so perfectly. You know, when we're born, that lens is clear and it's also flexible. And that flexibility is what gives everybody that beautiful full range of vision from distance to up close. And everybody typically in their 40s or 50s, that lens gets stiff. It can't zoom in and read up close anymore. And that's when people start to require reading glasses or bifocals. And then you're exactly right. It eventually gets cloudy. And that's what we call a cataract. So a cataract is your natural lens after it's become cloudy. And typically it's lost its flexibility as well. And so when we do cataract surgery, you know, historically, if we were to go back 20, 30 years ago, cataract surgery involved taking out the cloudy cataract and replacing it with a clear lens. But that lens didn't provide any necessary flexibility or range of vision. It didn't give back some of that reading vision that people had lost. And it was still a beautiful surgery and still gave people outstanding results because they were no longer looking through a cloudy cataract. But they would typically need glasses for both distance and up close to kind of refine it or to get it perfect because they didn't have a flexible lens. And what's really been amazing, and I've had the privilege of being a part of a lot of the FDA research trials that for some of these different lenses, is that we've now developed a lot of these lenses that are called extended depth of focus or bifocal or trifocal lenses. And the jargon of them doesn't necessarily matter, or the name associated with them doesn't matter. But really the concept, and you described it perfectly, is it gives you back some of that range of vision that you had lost. And it allows people to not only get nice distance vision correction, but then blend into the arm's length and up close as well, which can be really transformational. And as I always tell people, they're amazing. It's amazing technology, and the advancements even in the last 5 years continue to just be remarkable. It's still not as good as the lens we were born with. And, you know, again, the lens we were born with gave us that full range of vision by being flexible. And these lenses kind of bend light, or what we term diffractive optics, but kind of shape light to give you these different focal points. But it is really, really incredible. And so for patients that are interested in a little more visual freedom with cataract surgery, we can still put a single focus lens in like we traditionally did 20, 30 years ago. But we can also use cataract surgery as an opportunity to give people back some of their reading vision like we did with you, which can be really, really amazing because so much of our life, you think about, you know, I just think about my day to day, how much time I'm looking at a computer or a dashboard or my cell phone or all of these things that are kind of in this intermediate range. But like you, I love to wake up in the morning, go to bed at night. I like to drive, see clearly. I like to look up out the window and see the Bridgers and see the Gallatin range. And like, those things are really important as well. And so to preserve that range is a really nice opportunity that we now have.
And, you know, having been through the surgery, I'd like to mention that it was very comfortable. I went in and just went to sleep for a little while. And when I woke up, I had no pain or discomfort at all. And as I came out of the room walking out, they handed me a muffin. It was blueberry, I believe, and a cup of tea. As I told the next person coming in, my goodness, it's almost fun. It's not difficult at all.
Yeah, and I always try to sneak a muffin, but the nurses never let me sneak the muffins. They always keep them for everyone else. I'm like, I need a muffin too.
I ate every crumb of it. It was so good. And
Well, and I think you highlight something there. You know, there is, you know, to the point of it is our eyes, and there is a lot of natural fear that comes with that. And I always tell people, you know, even though I may do 20, 25 surgeries in a day and may do, you know, 2,000, 3,000 surgeries in a year, for any individual patient, that's the first time that they're going to have cataract surgery ever. And so it's really normal to have some anxiousness and nerves because you've never experienced it before. And that is the beauty of getting that little bit of relaxing medicine. I always tell people it makes me a faded memory, which is how I'm best remembered. It's kind of faded. And makes those, you know, 6 to 8 minutes of cataract surgery just really easy for a patient to go through, which is nice.
Well, while we're talking about what you do, for anyone out there, could you perhaps tell us where your office is located and give us a phone number just so that if they wanted to get in touch with you, I know you'd counsel them wherever they ended up going. And so perhaps you could take a minute and do that, Dr. Russell.
Yeah, that's very kind of you. Yeah. So my practice that I'm associated with is called Vance, V-A-N-C-E, Thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N, Vision. And we're in Bozeman. We're located on 19th Street, kind of in between Durston and Oak. And then, as I mentioned, we have an office in Billings that I spend some time at. And that's kind of over by 17th and Pauley near Rocky. And then just from a phone number perspective, our office number is 406-219-0700. And one of the things I always like to share, just almost as a public service announcement, as a PSA for anyone when it comes to eye care, I think it's really, really important to have annual routine eye exams to check on your eyes. There's so many things that, you know, I mentioned and kind of conditions that we want to watch for and monitor and catch early: glaucoma, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy. There's so many important things to have a yearly primary eye care exam with an optometrist in the community that are really critical. And honestly, we get a lot of calls about, hey, I'd like to have you, you know, get a glasses check or come in and just get a screening, you know, routine yearly eye exam. And as much as I would love to be able to provide that aspect of care, one of the realities of eye care, and it goes into kind of the numbers we talked about at the beginning, is the reality of eye care as an industry in today's day and age is a very collaborative model where primary eye care, glasses, contacts, monitoring of early diabetic retinopathy, macular degeneration, glaucoma, oftentimes happens in a primary eye care facility. And at least at our office, you know, we don't do any primary eye care exams, but that then allows us to be able to efficiently take care of people when they have a need and it's a complex medical issue, an infection, or if they have a surgical need or otherwise. And I just mentioned that because if somebody does call in and they say, hey, I'm really interested in an eye exam specifically for our office, that we don't do glasses or contacts or routine eye care, but it is still incredibly, incredibly important and something that I would encourage everyone to make sure that they're doing on a yearly basis.
Annually, okay.
Annually, yep.
I was noticing in an article from the CDC this year that we need to also think about our children. Just one out of every 7 preschoolers receives an eye exam, and fewer than one out of every 4 receives some type of vision screening. And there are numerous conditions that might be discovered when children are screened. So we need to make sure that our children also are given the opportunity to have an eye exam. The ones at this school are helpful, but they miss over 70% from the CDC of things that yep. could happen with the child's vision. So they're pretty yep. rudimentary. Could you maybe give parents an update about what to do about children?
Yeah, that's a great point. And myself having four kids running around our house, this is hot on my mind because my wife has perfect eyes. And as I mentioned, I did not have perfect eyes before I had laser vision correction. And I think, you know, to your point, screening exams at schools are really important, but they don't catch everything. And part of the reason for that is, you know, I like to say kids are really smart and they always want to pass a test when they can. And so those are designed to, you know, see if somebody has poor vision on one side or the other. But kids are really good about if one eye sees more poorly than the other, maybe using the other eye, not cheating necessarily, but using their resources to try to do well on a screening test. And one of the things I would say that's really improved in this regard in the last 5 years that's very helpful and is something that, you know, parents should pay attention to when they're at their pediatrician office, there's actually a lot of pediatrician offices now that have some screening visual devices. And it actually almost typically looks like almost like a handheld large Polaroid camera. But it actually does a analysis to determine if a kid has a high degree of nearsightedness, farsightedness, high degree of astigmatism, or if their what we call their red reflex or their light reflex of their eyes is appropriate or not. And that's really critical in the first year of life that a pediatrician's thinking about that as well. But then again, as a kid gets into their early school years, that can be really important. And there's some very subtle things that parents can be aware of. Like, you know, sometimes that can be a kid struggling at school all of a sudden when maybe, you know, last year or the year before they were doing really well at school. But a teacher may say, gosh, they're just not paying attention as much, or they're struggling to read or follow along quite like I would expect them to. I mean, sometimes that can just be a simple thing. Well, they can't see the whiteboard anymore or the projector like they used to. And so just being cognizant of this. And I do think this is one place where, again, if they're not at their annual kind of pediatric appointment, getting a visual screening with some of this modern technology that a lot of pediatricians have, then seeing a primary eye care doctor, maybe, you know, at least once as someone's getting into their school years, can be yearly, at least every other year, just to pick up on and make sure that if a kid starts to develop nearsightedness when they're in second grade or fourth grade or sixth grade, that's picked up on an early pace, an early place, so that kids aren't detrimentally affected by that.
I had several questions.
Yeah.
Excuse their simplicity, but most of us don't understand them. What is astigmatism?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, as eye doctors, we throw around these words that are like a whole new language. Astigmatism is just a word that represents and says that someone's cornea, which is kind of the clear front windshield of the eye, instead of being perfectly spherical in shape and focusing light in a really uniform pattern, that it has kind of an irregular shape. And sometimes you'll hear eye doctors or patients will say, oh, my eye doctor said I had a football-shaped eye. Well, what that just means is part of the cornea is a little steeper and part of it's a little flatter. And that irregularity of the cornea can cause blurriness if it's not corrected. And astigmatism can be corrected with glasses. It can be corrected with contacts. It can be corrected with a laser. It can be corrected with an implantable contact lens or a lens at the time of cataract surgery. So there's lots of ways to correct it. But yeah, great question. It's just an irregular shape to the cornea. And honestly, about 70 to 75% of people, depending on the study that you look like, have a degree of astigmatism that's enough to have some degree of correction to it. So it's something that a lot of people have. It's just, you know, the majority, probably 50% of people, it's on the milder side. But as it goes from mild to more moderate or significant amounts, very important to have correction for it.
Thank you. And what is macular degeneration, wet and dry?
Yeah, so macular degeneration, one of the most common causes of vision loss in the United States that's irreversible, And, you know, macula, that term is just a representative term for the very center of the retina. The retina is kind of the back layer of the eye. The analogy that we used to use that's not as helpful now that everyone has iPhone, has phones with cameras on it, but it's almost like the camera film of the eye, if you were to think about a traditional camera. It's what takes the image that's focused onto the eye, and then it transmits that image via the optic nerve to the back of the eye, to the brain, and then the brain kind of processes it. But that the center of the retina is what's called the macula, and it's what accounts for the majority of our very fine central vision for reading, for driving, for recognizing faces. And macular degeneration is a condition, has some genetic preponderance, has some probably environmental factors, but is a condition where that center part of the retina develops these deposits. We call them drusen, but these deposits that then impact the vision and cause distortion of the vision or blurriness that's typically irreversible. And dry macular degeneration, kind of the most common form, depending on the study you look at, 80 to 90% of macular degeneration is the dry form, historically was the form everyone wanted to have. Because, you know, it's generally thought to be very slowly progressive. And we just monitor it. And, you know, for all of my career, historically, there wasn't any treatment for that. I'll come back to that in just a minute. Wet macular degeneration is a condition where somebody has dry macular degeneration. And then as a variation of that, they develop these kind of new blood vessels that are kind of leaking and actually leak fluid into and underneath the retina, which is why we call it wet. And historically, before we had treatment for that 10, 15 years ago, that was unfortunately, you know, kind of a really hard thing to talk to patients about, because they were probably within the next 6 to 12 months going to go legally blind because there was no good treatments for it. Shortly before I started my training in eye care, there's a huge breakthrough in the treatment for wet macular degeneration. Unfortunately, today there's lots of great options for treatments. It's typically an injection of medicine into the eye, which seems kind of scary, but if you talk to anyone who's had it done, is not so intolerable, and has really changed the course of wet macular degeneration, because oftentimes we can now halt or even reverse a little bit of the damage from wet macular degeneration, so long as it was caught early and it's continued to be monitored by a retina doctor. As I mentioned, dry macular degeneration, historically there wasn't any treatments. There's all sorts of research going into that. And actually in the last year, there's been a couple treatments that were recently FDA approved for a certain variation of dry macular degeneration called geographic atrophy. So some people may see on TV or otherwise advertisements for these things. And again, it's kind of a subvariant of dry macular degeneration. And the jury's still out in terms of how efficacious or, you know, how beneficial it is. But when it was tested, it was demonstrated to maybe slightly slow the rate of progression, not eliminate or reverse it, but maybe decrease the rate of progression of dry macular degeneration. And so there's a lot of discussion that goes into those decisions to treat or not to treat. And that's usually, you know, driven by a retina doctor who's studied that and kind of has dedicated their career to that area of the eye.
But another question, what is strabismus and how does it correct it?
Yep. So strabismus is just a term that is in reference to the eyes being misaligned or not pointing in the same direction. Strabismus, we, you know, generally think of the most common time that we see that is sometimes in kids, where their eyes may drift in or drift out, probably more commonly drift in. And sometimes that can actually be because a child is very, very farsighted. So if a kid who's, you know, a year or 2 years old, if their eyes want to always cross in, it's really important for them to see a pediatric ophthalmologist, have measurements, or an optometrist who specializes in pediatrics to see, are they really farsighted? Because some kids will actually cross their eye and all they need is a pair of glasses that treats their farsightedness and it'll straighten their eyes. Other conditions, both in children and adults, they have strabismus, eyes, you know, cross or aren't lined up correctly. And they need glasses with prism that will kind of line them up, or sometimes they can have a surgery by a strabismus surgeon, adult or pediatric strabismus surgeon, and they actually can detach the muscles that move the eye and reattach them in a new position to straighten the eye out so that it's pointing and working in the same direction. And it's critically important in kids, if they're found to have eyes that aren't lined up, to get that treated early, because a kid whose eyes are crossing, what will oftentimes happen as a kid is they will just ignore one eye, so they won't see double vision. And for the first about 7 years of our life, our visual pathway is developing between our eye and our brain. And so if a kid is ignoring, you know, half the vision, their right eye or their left eye, for a number of years, they can develop what we call amblyopia or a lazy eye. And no matter what we do in the future for them as an adult, they may never be able to see the 20/40 line or the 20/80 line or the 20/100 line, depending on how severe it is, because the wiring or the connection between their eye and their brain never fully developed because their eyes weren't lined up. So again, critically important for kids, you know, 5 or younger, at least 7 and younger, if there's any crossing at all, that they really need to be seen and try to reduce that, and sometimes actually have some patching of their eye to force them to use their weaker eye to kind of build up the strength of it.
Thank you, Dr. Russell. Our daughter in New York City and her husband are both screenwriters, film writers, filmmakers, and their circle of friends in recent days have been talking about a complaint they had, and almost all of them might be looking at a screen of a computer 8-10 hours a day, going over scripts, going over plans and meetings, and they talked about painful headaches, eye strain, blurred vision, and dry eyes. And yet when they went to the doctor and they had a full checkup, they were fine. So I found out there's a thing called computer vision syndrome or digital eye strain. And so for, especially since COVID, when so many are working at home, mainly on a computer, there's a whole lot that might occur, and perhaps you could talk with us about screen time.
Yeah, that's this is a modern epidemic that didn't exist if we were to go back 20 years, because we weren't staring at our cell phone devices or computer screens for that long. And, you know, just a couple of thoughts on that. You know, there is a lot of research going into this, what we kind of call digital eye strain. And there's a couple things that are probably tied in and related. And one of those first things that you mentioned is, you know, somebody may be experiencing some kind of dryness or blurriness or irritation. One of the things that we know, I term them activities of concentration, but we'll put that as driving, looking at a TV, looking at a screen, reading. One of the things that we do is we blink about half as much as we do in just daily conversation or when we're doing other things. And so when you have somebody who's, you know, going 6, 8, 10, 12, 16 hours a day working on a computer screen or playing video games or whatever that screen-based activity might be, again, every time we normally blink our eyes, we're bathing our cornea. We're kind of almost like the windshield of our eye. The eyelids come down and then they open up and they bathe the corneal surface in our natural tear film. And that natural tear film is really important for, one, crisp vision, because the tear film provides this beautiful water-tear-air interface for refracting or focusing light. But it also helps prevent our cornea, the surface of our eye, from being chronically exposed and drying out, and the nerve endings of our cornea getting irritated and causing scratchiness or light sensitivity or otherwise. And so, you know, you'll hear a lot of people with kind of different thoughts, opinions, or otherwise. I think in general, there's, you know, a nice rule that's called like the 20-20-20 rule, which talks about, you know, like if you're doing sustained computer work, if you can just kind of programmatically build into your head, hey, every 20 minutes or so, I'm going to stare off at an object at least 20 feet away, and I'm going to do that for at least 20 seconds. And the idea of that is a couple things. One, it just kind of takes you off of focusing on the up close, allows you to kind of blink more normally. The other thing that's really important and related to digital eye strain, we talked about, particularly for younger patients who have that, you know, robust focusing lens, when we're staring at a computer or looking up close, we're actually engaging what's called the ciliary body, but this muscle that sits behind that colored part of your eye, behind the iris, to change the shape of your lens and focus or zoom in up close. And so if we go, you know, 4, 8, 10, 12 hours without ever really relaxing it, it's almost like doing a small bicep curl for 4, 6, 8 hours. Your bicep is going to be real sore by the end of that. And so just periodically taking some breaks to kind of stare away and let that focusing muscle relax is also very helpful. And then, you know, there are some environmental things that can be helpful. I tell people, particularly if you're in an office setting or a house setting, you know, trying to avoid, if you're doing a lot of computer work, trying to avoid also having like an overhead fan, considering having some sort of desktop humidifier or something else to improve the humidity, particularly in Montana where it's super dry, that can be a big thing. And then the last part that, you know, there's kind of mixed thoughts on, but there's a lot of data going into it, is also looking at, you know, there's very unique wavelengths of light that are coming out from our screens. And if you read a lot online about this, which involves more screen time and getting digital eye strain, but if you read a lot online, you'll read a lot about, you know, people trying like blue light filters or glasses that basically filter out some wavelengths of blue or violet lights. And I would say that, you know, the science on that is mixed. There's certainly no harm. And I certainly have a lot of patients and even some family members, you know, who love having, they call them their kind of their computer glasses or digital glasses that don't have any correction, but just have that kind of built-in blue light filter that's filtering out some of these wavelengths that for whatever reason seem to be more stimulating in terms of creating digital eye strain and pain and discomfort. So those are kind of the big things that I think about that. I don't know if there's other questions or things around that that you wanted to hit on?
Well, I thought I could mention that what I read sort of alluded to blue light glasses and that there's no harm at all with those and they might help. And so you could try them and you can get them inexpensively at Walmart or order them very expensively online. Your choice there. The other thing that I noted about blue light, which comes off these screens that we watch, is one thing to be concerned about is that blue light might alter the brain's sleep rhythms when used close to bedtime. The brain thinks the screen light is daylight, and it can shift the body's sleep rhythm. So how would you recommend we counteract that, Dr. Swan?
Well, I feel like, Suzanne, I feel like you've been talking to my wife because she's always telling me, gosh, you know what? I shouldn't be staring at my little phone screen right before I go to bed. It's going to mess up my sort of natural circadian rhythms. I do think there is a lot of unique evidence looking at that. And I would also say, and I think this is where, you know, there's so much about the brain and the third of the brain that's designated to vision processing, that's still a great mystery to us, even with functional MRIs that let us study it and otherwise. But there are certainly people that are more sensitive to that and less sensitive to that. And I think it goes to the point that you've been brought up about the, blue light filter glasses. I always tell people, man, it never hurts to try. Because again, I have patients who just rave about them. I'm like, you cannot take these away from me. I love them. And they made just my digital experience so much more comfortable. And I've had people who try it like, didn't really make a difference. And I think the same could probably be said for that effect of, you know, late evening blue light exposure. That there's probably some things that we don't quite understand where some people are more sensitive to it than not. But again, I think it's one of those things where it certainly doesn't hurt to try to avoid it. And or, you know, if you are finding yourself because of jobs or whatever it might be, having to do some late night screen time, trying to have a blue light filter, glasses or otherwise, to kind of cut down on it, particularly if you're finding that you're doing those things currently and having some trouble kind of falling asleep or otherwise.
And always,
I always tell my wife, part of going to medical school was, you know, I learned to be able to fall asleep in like 2 seconds, no matter the situation. It's never been a problem for me, but that's another thing.
And always practice 20/20/20 to keep your eyes more relaxed as you do that.
Exactly right.
Work. Yep. So there's been a lot of talk in the media the last couple of years about the safety of over-the-counter eye drops. So I wonder if you could talk to folks out here and tell us what we need to know about using eye drops and what kind are good and what to avoid.
Great. Yeah, great question. And man, one of the things I like to do, just kind of on a monthly basis, is when I'm in the grocery store or at Walmart or Target or Costco, walk over to the eye section and just take a gander. And I feel like every time I go there, there's like 10 new over-the-counter eye drop choices to be overwhelmed by. And what I would say, you know, I kind of think of our over-the-counter drops in a couple different categories. The first and probably broadest category of drops would just be what we would term like an artificial tear drop, which is basically a lubricating eye drop for patients who are having dryness or digital eye strain or fatigue, where the surface, you know, tear film is not doing well enough, and so we're supplementing it with additional tears. And there are loads and loads of different artificial tears. Almost every, you know, there's all these big brand names, and then almost every, you know, Target, Walmart, otherwise have their own kind of off-brand of the exact same thing. And in general with those, what I tell people is if it's just a lubricating eye drop only, and we'll talk about what else could be on top of that, but it's just a lubricating eye drop only, whatever works well for you, is comfortable, and is the least expensive, is typically a very, very fair starting spot to go. And again, there's various formulations. There's ones that are more lipid-based. There's ones that are more water-based. There's ones that are more viscous or less viscous, or more like a gel or less like a gel. And again, everyone's kind of personal preference and what they find helps their eyes best is a little different there. Where there are some important considerations, I believe, are, you know, I tell patients you want to be really careful of drops that kind of say get the red out. Visine historically was, you know, eye doctor's big culprit, but I won't just pick on them. But any drop that kind of says, hey, get the red out, or, you know, reduce redness, typically those have a active medication that works by constricting the blood vessels on the white part of the eye. And so they actually work really well to temporarily get rid of the redness. But as that medication, that small percentage medication wears off, usually people get actually rebound redness. It's actually a little more than what was there before. And they kind of have this yo-yo back and forth. And so then they start to feel like, well, I have to have these drops, because when the drops wear off, then the redness gets even worse. And again, it's just because you kind of have this natural rebound. And so generally, if people can tolerate just a lubricating only drop without some of that get the redness out part, that's most beneficial. Then the other broad category within tear drops that's probably just worth noting is there's ones that have preservatives and there's preservative free. And, you know, as a general rule of thumb, most eye doctors kind of say, hey, if you're using a drop 4 times a day or less, it's probably fine to have a little bit of preservative in there. The preservative, what that means is if you're putting an eye drop in that's in a bottle form, that always has some preservatives in it, because it's what we term a multi-use device. So it reduces the risk of, you know, the fluid that's in there getting infected should you touch your eyelashes or touch it to the skin between things, that the drops inside aren't going to become contaminated. There's also preservative-free drops, and if you go into, you know, any drugstore or otherwise, those kind of look like kind of individual little vials. And again, what's nice about those is if you have somebody who's having to use tears more often, or if you just have somebody who's very sensitive, their eyes are very sensitive, that doesn't have these kind of natural preservatives because they're individual vials, and that can be a really nice option in somebody who maybe just has had a procedure or surgery, and their eyes are a little more irritated. or maybe they have a concurrent condition like glaucoma or something else that's requiring other eye drops, and we're trying to decrease the preservative burden on their eye. And then the last just kind of broader category that I mentioned, and particularly this time of year as we start to exit winter and enter springtime and then early summer, is going to be allergy season. And one of the really nice things that's happened over the last few years is a lot of what used to be required a prescription anti-allergy eye drops, the FDA kind of found, hey, you know what, these drops are safe enough, they have a very high safety profile, it's fine if we allow them to be over the counter. And so there's a lot of great anti-allergy drops that you can now get over the counter, which is nice. And particularly, you know, as we enter kind of the March, April, May timeframe, and everything's starting to bud and the pollen count's picking up, if people are experiencing dry, but more importantly, really itchy eyes, that's something that can be a really nice option to know is available to decrease how itchy someone's eyes might feel.
One physician friend asked me to ask you about the dryness after cataract surgery and what we could do about that. And I don't know if you think that eye drops that we're talking about now might help, or what you would say to that question, Dr. Russell.
Yeah, great question, Suzanne. But, you know, in general, I like to tell people anytime we pick on the eye in any form or fashion surgically, so cataract surgery, even though we're making just a few very small incisions, 2 millimeters or smaller, or if we're doing laser vision correction, LASIK or PRK, or if we're doing a cornea transplant or glaucoma surgery, anytime we're making incisions or laser treatment of the eye, and particularly of the cornea, it's not uncommon that we're going to kind of disrupt the sort of natural homeostasis of the tear film, of that nice tear film. And for most people, that's, you know, if we look at the studies, that's probably most noticeable the first month after LASIK or PRK, where we're actually lasering through some of the what we term corneal nerve plexus, or the corneal nerve fibers that help tell our eye to produce tears. But even when we make a very small incision like cataract surgery, you know, I tell people certainly the first couple of days, even up to the first week, pretty guaranteed that it's going to feel a little more scratchy and irritated. And you're exactly right. As a temporizing measure, those kind of lubricating teardrops can be very helpful. If somebody experiences persistent dryness after a procedure of the eye, one, you know, that would be more atypical than typical. You know, on average, again, by a month with cataract surgery, by 3 months after refractive surgery, LASIK or PRK, most people feel like from a dryness perspective, they're typically back to normal. But if somebody was still experiencing a little bit of dryness, you know, then we might have to talk about other treatment options, whether it be prescription drops or plugs that kind of keep someone's natural tears around a little longer, or increasing how much we're doing some of the tears. But yeah, if it's prolonged beyond those kind of time points, then it's probably worth having a follow-up conversation about.
Thank you. That's very helpful information that we all need to know. And you've probably seen the recent information from the CDC about if you are going to use eye drops, some of the things you should be thinking about, such as always wash your hands thoroughly before and after using the eye drops. Do not touch the tip of the eyedropper bottle to your eye or any other surface. Squeeze one drop of eye drop solution. Close your eye and press your finger against the inner corner of your eye for 1 to 2 minutes to keep that solution from draining out. Blot away any excess solution with a clean tissue. And so we all kind of take for granted when we do that, that it's an easy process, but we need to take care with that. Is that, I'm assuming that you would concur with what the CDC is saying here.
Yeah, absolutely. And who knew putting an eye drop in could be so hard, but it's true. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. And the other thing that's not on there is, you know, sometimes as a part of surgery, you may be asked to put 2 or 3 drops in, or patients with glaucoma may have to put 2 or 3 drops in, you know, at the same time point. And one of the things we always talk about there is, you know, we want to give a couple minutes between one drop before you do the next drop so that you're not washing out, you know, one with the other. And the kind of digital palpation thing that you mentioned, where you put a little pressure on the inside corner of the eye, the whole idea there is when we have overflow of tears or overflow of medication eye drops that we put in the eye, we have these natural tear drainage tubes that kind of run down into our nose. And that's why, you know, if we watch an emotional film or we're feeling rather emotional and we start crying, we also get a runny nose because those excess tears run down into our nose. And so that digital palpation can actually help occlude that drainage system and open up and decrease kind of how much gets absorbed down into your nose and systemically, which is nice. And so, do you mind if I just throw in a quick word? Because around eye drops, and we've mentioned a couple times glaucoma, but do you mind if I take us on a quick glaucoma tangent, just because there's something really unique and exciting that's new in the world of glaucoma care in the last couple months around eye drops?
We would love to go there with you.
Okay, sounds good. So, you know, just a quick overview. Glaucoma is just a term we use. It's a condition where someone's optic nerve, which is, again, that cable that connects the eye to the brain, develops progressive damage. And it's the leading cause of irreversible blindness in the world, the second leading cause of irreversible blindness in the U.S., second or third, depending on the study you look at. But what's tricky about it is it affects someone's peripheral vision first, and it's painless, so a lot of people don't notice it. And again, reason for yearly exams. But once it's been identified, the way we treat glaucoma is typically it's associated with the pressure inside the eye being too high, and so we try to lower the pressure. And historically, the first line of treatment for that was eye drops. Actually, there's really good evidence and studies to show now that the first line of treatment, maybe even before eye drops, could be a laser treatment that may be able to delay someone needing eye drops by a year or two. But the reason I wanted to bring it up, the new thing that we were actually part of the FDA trial for, and it just got approved in the last couple months, and actually last week was the first time it was, you know, commercially placed inside of an eye outside of the U.S. research trial, is a device called iDose. But it's remarkable technology. And the idea is, you know, we mentioned putting in eye drops should be easy, but it's actually not that easy. And interestingly, you know, about 50% of people who we prescribe drops for glaucoma, and they're supposed to take the glaucoma drop on a daily basis, once or twice a day. Depending on the study you look at, 50 to 75% of people 6 months later will not be following that regimen correctly. They may have either stopped it because of irritation or cost or whatever it might be. And this iDose is a device that actually can be implanted inside the eye. And instead of somebody having to put a drop in every day, at night, once a day, it actually releases slowly medication inside the eye for up to 3 years, which is incredible. And it's a canister that's less than a millimeter in length and size, less than half a millimeter in width, very, very small, micro amounts of medication that are just very, very slowly eluted or released inside the eye. And it's, again, there's so many areas of eye care that are really, you know, unique and exciting for the research that's going into them. But this is a huge, huge game changer for patients, you know, where eye drops might be challenging to get in, or the cost may be significant, or the drops may just be very irritating to the surface, even though they help. The beautiful part about implanting it inside the eye is that medicine can just slowly release inside the eye. And as part of the FDA trial, they also showed once that medicine has ran out, they can actually just go in and remove that canister and replace it with a new one, you know, 3 years down the road. So instead of having to do a drop every day for, you know, 1,000 days over 3 years, somebody could just have a canister placed that would replace that, which is pretty amazing and really, really exciting. So
that's exciting. That truly is. Yeah.
Did I see an advertisement on TV about an eye drop that improves vision at least for a few hours?
Yes. So probably, I think what you're probably thinking about is an eye drop that's called Vuity. And Vuity is an eye drop that's kind of recently been approved with the idea that it's trying to reduce people's dependence on reading glasses. So we talked about, you know, people lose that flexibility of their lens. They can't zoom in and read up close. And there's about 15 different pipeline drugs right now being studied. We just finished a trial on another one of them. Here in Bozeman just in this last couple of weeks. but are looking at ways to try to increase people's range of reading vision a little longer. And Vuity is the first one that was approved in the FDA. It interestingly doesn't really have an impact on the flexibility of the lens, but what it instead does is actually causes a little mild constriction or shrinking of the pupil. And that creates what we call a pinhole optic effect, but it actually increases people's range of vision for their up close for a couple hours. And particularly in patients who are maybe in their late 40s or 50s, can help decrease their dependence on reading glasses. Now, when you constrict your pupil in a kind of semi-permanent way, meaning you've stimulated it, what happens is at night, if you go to drive at night, and you now have stimulated the constricting muscle of the pupil, as it can't relax quite as much. And so sometimes people's nighttime quality of vision or the amount of light they get in, when normally at night our pupil gets really big, if the pupil is kind of staying small because it's been pharmacologically activated with the eye drop, nighttime vision can be a little more interesting. And so I always tell patients to kind of walk into that slowly and or just use the drop at the beginning of the day. But it is a newer medication. And I think, you know, when we talk about next 5-10 years, there's probably, we might have 5 or 6 different medication eye drops that kind of work in a similar pattern to that, which will be nice.
That's exciting too. I wonder, as we're getting near the end here, if you wouldn't one more time go over where people can find you and what your phone number is, should they have more questions about any aspect of this.
Yeah. Happy to follow up if there's ever questions that come up. Again, I work at Vance Thompson Vision, and that's vancethompsonvision.com. Or our phone number for our office in Bozeman is 406-219-0700. And we also have an office in Billings, and you can call that same number. That's totally fine. But yeah, if there's follow-up questions that come from that or other things that people are interested or learning more about, can find on our website, but also always just feel free to give us a call.
We're approaching the end of the session here. The program, you've done extremely well. We appreciate all the terrific knowledge, and I'm sure the listeners do as well. We'd like to invite all of the people listening to tune in to this program weekly, Monday evenings and Thursday mornings, KGVM 95.9 FM, or the internet, kgvm.org. Plus, you can go to the internet and go down to the archives under Health and Happiness and listen to any program, usually over the past year or two, by going into that catalog of programs. But this will be available to you even after the live program on Monday evenings and Thursdays. Suzanne, any final words?
I just think that we've seen thrilling forays into the future here in all of the wonderful developments about eyes. I noticed last year using the vision doctors and the hearing doctors together, they created a football helmet for deaf kids using visual cues, where they could read the plays inside the helmet and they were projected. So there's so many different ways that the quality of our lives are being impacted, and we accuse you of being one of those who's causing this impact, Dr. Swan. We really appreciate every bit of that time you spent learning and how you teach, and we appreciate you coming on the show after a long day of surgeries, and we just can't thank you enough for what you do for all of us.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure, and again, I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to spend time with both of you and just share some time together. It was just absolutely fantastic. So you guys have a great rest of your day, and hope all the listeners do the same.
Thank you, and good evening.